The meeting of the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee will come to order for the Tuesday, March 11th meeting. And we're in a situation where it happens to be deadline week, and most of our members are in three places at one time and jumping back and forth. So we are going to start the meeting, and I see that Senator Kubley is here, and if you would like to present your bill. We are going to try to move things along as quickly as possible, Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sure that would be fine with us. For Senate File 3160, Madam Chair and members, there is a delete all amendment that looks at the qualifying owners for seabed systems and sets a level at which production could take place under that kind of scenario. But, I don't know if you want to move the amendment, Madam Chair. I guess that would be fine, or...
Senator Kubley, we don't have enough members to move it yet. So what we'll do is lay it over and adopt it as soon as we have the members checked in.
All right, that'd be fine. Yeah, okay.
But you can discuss it.
Yeah, well, with me today is Commissioner Bob Fox from Renville County. He's been working on this kind of an idea for quite some time with some other partners, and I'd like to give him the opportunity to speak to the committee and explain a little bit.
Okay, welcome, Commissioner Fox.
Thank you. Bob Fox, Renville County Commissioner. I also serve as Vice Chair of the Rural Minnesota Energy Board. Madam Chair and Senators, the Rural Energy Board makes up 18 counties in southwest and south central Minnesota. We've worked also with the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition, which is made up of Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, Sherburne, and Washington. Our goal is here to get language clarified, and that is our main purpose, so we can help with local seabed projects. And that is our main purpose. We have worked with all the utilities in this project, so the utilities are all on board. We want to help seabed go along and to help our economic development in rural areas. This project was represented in a different bill last year, and with extensive discussion with the utilities to craft language before you today for your consideration. Utilities we met with were fully engaged, helpful, and responsive. Those discussions have made it possible for us to express confidence today in the support of this proposal. Who benefits? Given support from the utilities, I can say that everyone will benefit from this effort, rural and metro taxpayers, local government that want to spur local development, and those trying to keep the lid on escalating price for electricity. Utilities try to meet mandates set by Minnesota Renewable Energy Standards. Local investors seeking homegrown energy production, small wind developers, and ratepayers who share equally in the cost of savings as we work to increase our energy security, improve air quality, and reduce emissions of greenhouse gases. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Senator Olsen.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm struck by a paragraph going to like four pages or three pages. That's quite a growth in the bill. Could we get walked through that a little?
Well, I was going to ask for that, so thank you. Thank you for that. Perhaps, Senator Kubley, you could walk through the bill and explain what changes are occurring here.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, I guess, I'm willing to do that. But primarily it's looking at a local government unit. In this case, it's identified as counties or the Met Council, and they are authorized by this bill to generate a certain amount of electrical energy. Usually, I believe that would be with a wind energy conversion system, although I think that's up on line 113. You'll notice it refers to it as a wind energy conversation system. Certainly, there's conversation going on about it, but I believe that's a typographical error, Madam Chair. But you notice down on line 1.23 that it's limited to a total of 10 megawatts. 216B is the renewable energy statute, Senator Olsen. And then under Section 3, you know, it just defines project, and then it goes on and talks about, you know, a county might, you know, in cooperation with other counties, you know, enter into a purchase agreement for electrical energy, and that they can only sell it at the wholesale rate. And, you know, they continue to honor the service areas that are already in place. At the top of the page 2, you notice that they can acquire an ownership interest in a project for electrical energy that is produced. And again, on 2.5, it's limited to 10 megawatts. Then under the next subdivision, you know, it talks once again about, you know, entering into agreements with other counties. And then, you know, Section 4 deals specifically with the Met Council. And I believe, you know, that's where the Rural Energy Board is working with the metropolitan area to get something that is acceptable to both entities.
Any questions or comments? Senator Olsen.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Commissioner Fox, how come you're looking at just 10 megawatts? It seems like a lot of these new generators are like 4.5, and that would really limit the...
Chair, Senator,
Commissioner Fox.
I believe that number is negotiable, and they're still working on that number. I've seen different numbers in here. This is the number I just saw today that's in here. It could be a larger number, but whatever is comfortable for everybody just to get this to move forward. I agree with you. It could be a higher number.
Senator Olsen, Commissioner Fox, Senator Kubley, this has been a discussion in this committee before. I think before you were authorized for 3 megawatts, is that correct?
Right.
So this is quite a jump from that. There was always a question about whether that was appropriate to authorize a governmental entity to be in competition with the private sector. So
yeah, that's correct, Madam Chair, and I think we've had this discussion around school districts also.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Fox.
I guess one thing I'd like to use an example. Years ago when the ethanol industry was starting up, and I was here testifying to help that industry start, there was a lot of local REAs that came to the point when they were just about there but weren't quite ready to have enough money to help get them over the top. And I look at this as the same way. There's a lot of economic development could happen, and maybe that last 3% or 5%, they just don't quite have the money, and a county or counties could go in and help that project, you know, come over the top.
Any further discussion or questions? At this time, we do have a quorum, and so is there a motion from the committee to adopt the delete all amendment?
Madam Chair, I'll move the A3 amendment. I think on line 1.13, that's probably not supposed to say conversation.
That's right, conversion.
I'd incorporate that.
Okay, so Senator Anderson moves the A3 amendment with the oral change in line 1.13. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Nay. Motion prevails. Then on the bill. Senator Rosen moves that Senate file 3160 be recommended to pass and re-referred to state and local government operations. Pardon?
Okay,
as amended. Any discussion? Then all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate your time.
Senator Anderson.
Oh, thank you.
If you would take 3540, actually, we need to take first. We're trying to get the policy bills out of here first before 6 o'clock, so...
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I actually, I can explain both of the bills at the same time, if that's all right with you, and just have 3540 in front of us first. My witnesses are, they go together, and my witnesses were going to talk about the concept in general. Senate file, so is that all right if I talk about them both?
Yes, okay.
Senate file 3539 and 3540 both relate to creating an intentional, specific, aggressive plan for the state to mesh our environmental and energy policies with our economic development policies and our workforce development policies. And so what we are doing here is figuring out, taking the policies that Minnesota has established a leadership position in, and there's five big bills that we passed over the last few years. Number one, the renewable energy standard. Number two, the energy efficiency goals of 1.5% energy efficiency improvement every year. Number three, the greenhouse gas reduction goals authored by Senator Prettner-Solin in the Next Generation Energy Act that call for greenhouse gas reductions over the next decades throughout the state. Number four, the Clean Water Legacy Act. And number five, our law that sets a goal in place for 25% biofuels by 2025. So you put all of those bills together, and that shows you the leadership position that Minnesota has taken in these areas over the last several years in passing that policy legislation. And many of us, certainly when I've been trying to promote the renewable energy standard year after year, part of my pitch to all of you was that it would create jobs, it would bring economic development and investment to Minnesota and revitalize our rural communities, create jobs and attract those wind turbine manufacturers to our state and have a lot of economic development benefits. Now, we've had some discussion in this committee. Senator Dahl had a bill last year to start that process of discussion. But I don't think we've gotten quite those results that we're hoping for. And so these bills are an effort to try to jumpstart those, and again, to be more intentional about how we take those policies, those energy and environmental policies, and turn them into jobs and economic development in our state. So the first bill, Senate File 3539, takes some of the existing economic development programs that we have in the Department of Employment and Economic Development, the Minnesota Investment Fund and the Redevelopment Funds, along with the Job Skills Partnership Board, which does the workforce training programs for incumbent workers to help prepare them for new jobs or better jobs. And so Senate File 3539 puts a green spin on those programs and establishes a definition of a green economy and says that we want one of the factors to be considered in making those economic development grants to be how it can help Minnesota meet those goals of our policy laws that we put into place. So that's the first bill. And the second bill creates a green jobs, let's see, I like the name of it, so I want to read the exact name. The Green Jobs Transformation Task Force. And this is a task force that would be put together consisting of legislators, state agency leaders, and a variety of business and labor representatives and higher education representatives from the outside of the Capitol to work together put together a plan for how we can move to the next steps of creating leadership position for our state in the green economy and creating those jobs in our state. And we specifically in that bill ask this task force to commission a couple of critical studies. I guess there's three of them, actually. A market analysis of what, if you look at all those bills that we passed, what market do they establish, and what development will be required to meet those markets. So, for example, in the renewable energy standard, we are looking at putting 5,000 or 6,000 megawatts of wind onto the ground, mostly in Minnesota, to meet the requirements of the renewable energy standard by 2020. That's going to require several thousand wind turbines to be manufactured and constructed and maintained across the state of Minnesota. And so we want to figure out what all the different components of getting that job done would be. And so we'll look at the marketing, or excuse me, at the market that exists already, the manufacturing base, to put those components together. And then we'll look at the workforce needs to also create those results and to get those get the pieces, put the workforce on the ground to build those wind turbines, to put those solar panels in place, to insulate the homes, all the pieces that will be needed to meet those policy goals that we've established into law. So that's a very quick summary. I would just to point out a couple of key facts. In Minnesota, we have, according to Deed, we've lost over 50,000 manufacturing jobs in our state at the beginning of this century, between 2000 and 2006. And we know from studies, and you'll see that in your handout, studies have been done that show that the potential for creating new, high-quality, living-wage manufacturing jobs in our state is in the range of 18,000 new jobs. We know that renewable energy production, for example, is labor-intensive and manufacturing-intensive, so that the pieces of this overall policy that will require renewable energy will create specifically a lot of manufacturing jobs, and a lot of the other pieces will as well. So essentially what we're doing in both of these is trying to coordinate our energy and environmental policies with our economic development and workforce policies. And both of these bills have gone through Senator Metzen's Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee, and now we're presenting this to you. And I have two witnesses who would like to talk about this, Lynn Hinkle from the United Auto Workers and Dave Foster from the Blue-Green Alliance.
Right.
So, Dave,
you
first?
Yeah. I'm going to ask you to try to keep your comments to about 3 minutes each.
Okay. I will. I'll abbreviate what I had to say, Madam Chairperson. Thank you very much, members of the committee. I'm David Foster, the Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance. We're a public policy partnership of the United Steelworkers, North America's largest manufacturing union with 850,000 members, and the Sierra Club, our country's oldest and largest environmental organization with 1.3 million members and supporters. I served for 31 years as a member of the United Steelworkers and ran the union in this part of the country for 16 years. We're strongly in support of these two Senate bills, 3539 and 3540, because we think this idea of capturing economic development through environmental investments is the way to create jobs in the 21st century. I used to think that this was a hypothetical proposition. Now I'm seeing all around me the evidence of this reality. Germany, which is farther down the road than we are, now has 1.4 million jobs in what it characterizes as its environmental sector. Spain, which has invested heavily in renewable energy, now has 200,000 jobs in the renewable energy sector alone, a country of only 35 million people. The strongest evidence, I think, of this proposition today that environmental policy creates job markets is in the renewable energy standards that this state and others have passed around the country. We've seen very rapid job growth in renewable energy. In the three-state area surrounding us, six plants have opened up, employing over 2,200 people, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Iowa, in the last 4 or 5 years. We are now home to the largest wind installer in North America, the Mortenson Construction Company. On any given day, 1,000 union tradesmen are putting up wind turbines in 16 sites around North America. And this is a spillover industry as well. My union, the United Steelworkers, at the ArcelorMittal steel plant in Indiana, called 250 steelworkers back to work last summer, specifically to make plate for wind turbine installations all over the country. That's Minnesota iron ore going into Indiana blast furnaces to create jobs for steelworkers. I want to just close by observing that what has become popularly called green-collar jobs that are created by focusing on the green economy are not necessarily new jobs in occupations that haven't yet been invented. And I know that we'll probably have some of those kinds of jobs, but to me the real value of the green economy is how we reinvigorate the economy we've got by transforming it to make the efficiency and renewable products that we need. So the steelworker who's making that plate steel in Indiana today out of iron ore from Minnesota is now part of the green economy. precisely because the steel he or she is making is going into a wind turbine that's helping us solve the global warming crisis. So green-collar jobs can be high-tech and experimental, but frankly, most of the green-collar jobs will be blue-collar jobs done for a green purpose. And that's why we support these two important pieces of legislation. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate File 3539 and Senate File 3540 on behalf of the UAW, and we're aligned with the support from the Minnesota AFL-CIO. Both the Senate File 3539 and, excuse me, let me step back and introduce myself. I'm Lynn Hinkle. I spent 20 of my 30 years at the Ford plant as a union official, and I'll be honest, I finally had to retire last year so I could devote full time to trying to convert our facility into a green manufacturing facility. And I've continued to do that in a number of different ways, one of which is working with Dave and Senator Anderson on the Mayor's Green Manufacturing Initiative, as well as working on a coalition of environmental, transit, housing, and labor organizations committed to a green manufacturing future on the Ford site. Again, both the bills in question, Senate File 3539 and Senate File 3540, are much needed for Minnesota if it intends to develop the capacity for good green jobs based on the groundbreaking legislation that calls for increased renewable energy production, energy conservation, greenhouse gas mitigation, though it's so critical for our future, and biofuels production. Developing this capacity is critical for securing a significant place in the green jobs market. Now, Ford's closure, their announcement of the closure of our plant, helps to bring into very stark focus the loss of 48,000 other good manufacturing jobs in this state. And just think about it. I mean, we're so used to seeing figures like 50,000 jobs lost in a decade or perhaps two, but the figures that we're looking at right now are the decline of 50,000 manufacturing jobs. That's the core. That's the productive capacity of this state that's gone away in a very short period of time. And the 2,000 jobs at the Ford plant, as I indicated, are a startling reminder of that. But it's going on all over the state in many other locations. Many parts of the new energy economy that we passed groundbreaking legislation to deal with last session will potentially provide significant family-sustaining jobs. And let me just mention a couple. Dave talked about the renewable energy project report. And in that report, I think copies of it have been distributed to everyone, it talks about Minnesota's role over the next 10 years and the potential for 18,500 jobs just in the manufacture of renewable energy equipment. Now, that's a startling projection. It's not startling because it's not potential, but it really begins to tell the story about what the potential alignment of economic growth to the development of environmental progress in this state. One of the other areas that I think we could look at is the projection based on information that's been researched by the Apollo Alliance. And they talk about the ability to create 2,000 jobs for every 100 large buildings that are retrofitted for energy conservation, another aspect of the reduction of energy demand that has been called for in our state. And part of that 2,000 jobs for every 100 large building is the result of looping in or including manufacturing jobs. So, again, what these bills are doing, in my view, are creating that capacity, because there is sometimes an assumption that if you just create the demand for the wind turbines, then they're just going to show up to manufacture those wind turbines. If we've just created the demand for high-performance HVAC systems in new high-performing green buildings, then somehow the production capacity for that is going to automatically or almost magically appear. And I think we all realize that without this type of legislation to build the capacity, that won't happen. None of this is automatic. And these two bills combine to focus DEED's capacity on the green jobs engine that's potential in this state, in the green economy that's emerging. While the task force, the transformation task force, will create financially and organizationally the ability to complement those activities indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments for Senator Anderson or the testifiers? And let's take one bill at a time. And
sure.
Senator Anderson, I'm understanding that 3539 has to go to finance also.
Has it been requested by finance?
By economic
by
development.
Yeah. Sure. Okay, that's fine. I would, if there's no further discussion, I would move that Senate File 3539 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Were there any amendments to this bill?
There were not today.
Nobody was offering an amendment.
To the next bill.
To the next bill.
Okay. Then on Senator Anderson's motion that 3539 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance Division or Committee, is any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And we'll now look at 3540. Any questions or comments? I think, did you have an amendment?
I have an amendment that I've been asked to introduce. It's amendment A1. This is an amendment I think that you have talked about with Senator Rosen.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen it yet, though.
The amendment, I think it's going to be passed around now. In essence, it takes the language on 1.20 of Senate File 3540 and changes the language from co-chairs of the task force and inserts the governor. And in effect, what this amendment would do, it would be to change and give the governor the authority to make those appointments from private industry as well. The reasoning I think that I'd like to represent for Senator Rosen is, since this will be a group, a task force that will advise and assist the governor and the legislature, that we want to make certain that the composition is such that that we are able to align and engage the governor in the process.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I did talk to Senator Rosen about this yesterday and today, and I indicated to her I would be happy if the task force was 50-50, appointed by 50% by the legislature and 50% by the governor, but I think this shifts the balance more towards the governor. And so, let's see, we have six legislators on it, six members appointed by the governor in paragraph two. And so I don't really think it's appropriate to make the other six also appointed by the governor, which I think this amendment would do. So, and I just had a chance to talk with her about this briefly before she left. So, you know, if we want to split the difference and be 50-50, I think I would be willing to agree to that. But I don't see any reason why the governor should have the appoint the majority of members of this task force that I'm proposing. I think we need to work hand-in-hand with the executive branch on this. So I would suggest maybe we should change it from that the governor could appoint three of those people from the private sector. But then we'd need some language to state that a little bit differently.
Senator Anderson, you'd have to identify which of the three from those six different industries would be appointed by each of those appointing authorities.
Check the notes.
Okay. Why don't I propose that the governor would appoint a member representing the utility industry, financial institutions, and venture capital. And then the task force legislators would appoint a member representing labor, manufacturing, and one additional member. So then we'll have 50-50 representation. I think that would be appropriate. I'm fine with that.
Okay. Senator, Senator Sharon, would you be agreeable to that?
Could we discuss a little? Can you? I don't know what the procedure is for sure, but if I could discuss a little further. I can also say that I feel a little awkward here representing Senator Rosen, but that she understood that and was amenable to that idea. So I can report that, but I would like to speak to my own. I just want to raise transparency to, if we're talking about balance, that in the first group where the legislators are selected, two of those would be from the minority party. I don't know if that creates any kind of issue in terms of balance.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon,
Senator Anderson.
This bill has to go to Senator Rest Committee next, and they have very strong. Oh, Senator Sparks is on that committee. I went through their committee last week and heard they have patterns about how they like to do things, and generally when you have legislative appointments, they represent the component, the makeup of the legislature, so that it's typically, if there's three, it would be two would be from the majority party and one from the minority party, one from the House and the Senate, and that's why we wrote it this way. And then if the majority party changed, it would still have those, it would still be representative.
Well, thank you.
So, Senator Sharon, would you be agreeable to that amendment to your amendment?
Yes.
And then if it's okay with the body, I'll entertain further discussion later, but if we could just let Senate Council work on that intent, and it will be ready when you get to your next committee, if that's okay. It'll be in the report.
Madam Chair, that's fine with me. I think it is just a technical matter to incorporate those changes, so I'd be very comfortable with that.
Okay, then on the amendment, any discussion?
The amendment as amended or?
Yeah, okay. The amended amendment.
Right.
Do we have to? I think Senator Sharon has accepted that as part of her amendment, so.
Sure.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment, A1 amendment, then, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I wanted to make an oral amendment, if I may.
Yes.
The market analysis, the three studies that are listed on the bottom of page 2, market analysis of business opportunities and needs, analysis of the labor force, and inventory of current labor and business assets. That would be, I would intend to try to fund that in my division, so I would like to, and that's what the appropriation is for the contract to do that market analysis. So I would, on line 2.35, I would like to strike employment and economic development and insert commerce.
Okay. Did everybody understand that? That this would be through the Department of Commerce rather than Employment and Economic Development.
And then, Madam Chair, I wouldn't have to ask Senator Tomasoni to fund this.
Okay. would anybody care to speak to the amendment? Then all in favor of that oral amendment that on 2.35 we strike Employment and Economic Development and insert Commerce, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Anderson.
If with the understanding on the technical amendment, I would move that Senate File 2540 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
Correct. On Senator Anderson's amendment or motion, is there any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much for squeezing us in. We really appreciate that.
Sure. And then next is Senator Jungbar. We're trying to get through the policy bills first. Senator Jungbar.
Good.
Senator Junkar.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. You know, I was first thinking when I looked at the schedule that since we had the blue-green alliance and this green energy thing, maybe we should have the red-green alliance, because if anybody likes red-green, you know, he's comes up with some pretty good job ideas and some pretty good inventions. So I figured I could get away with levity a little bit since we didn't have a whole crowd here yet.
We're dealing with 3341 at this time.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. 3341, I have an A1 author's amendment I'd like to put on there before we deal with.
Okay. Senator Jungbar offers the A1 amendment, an author's amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 3341, you can start your time clock. I'm trying to do this in a quick time. This is a non-mandatory bill, but it's a bill to kind of get us ready for inventorying, and it could be even carbon footprints and stuff, but it goes beyond that and asks for other things, electric use, heating use or heating type, air conditioning type, water use, corporate vehicles. And what I envisioned with this bill is at the federal level, there is $10 billion available in grant monies to cities to do municipalities to do an inventory on CO2 and carbon footprints within cities and trying to really get a greenhouse gas emissions inventory. And this bill starts us in that direction. But I also thought if we're working in that direction, cities really need a good bill that gives a planning tool for cities for expansion in terms of infrastructure needs. And it's also a good tool for businesses to use. Because I think, Madam Chair and members, a lot of businesses really don't know and they don't look annually at their energy use, their water use, what kind of consumption their fleet of vehicles might have and things. So in order to allow cities a quicker access at those grant monies and for businesses to kind of be able to say, where are we in terms of energy use? And then they could kind of monitor their own and really be cognizant of how they might reduce their own energy use, water use, and emissions. So it's a pretty simple bill. It would be sent out and allow businesses to put online all their uses under these different categories.
Is there discussion about the bill? Did you have anybody to testify?
I didn't have anybody to testify. We had a lot of comments and input. Businesses were a little worried about it at first because of the potential to have to separate out different types of use. So if you had, say, gas, water, heat, and gas furnaces, that you'd have to separate out which were putting out or using specific amounts of energy, and that's what the A1 amendment did, was actually say we're just looking at the overall total use of energy under electricity, gas, your air conditioning type in case you're air conditioning with groundwater, your actual water use, and again, to kind of get us ready for some of those grant monies that are available at the federal level, but for inventories of businesses knowing and being able to kind of watch their own energy use and water use and get on track to do some conservation measures within their own businesses.
Anybody wish to speak for or against the bill? Okay, then Senator Jungbar.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sanjum.
Madam Chair and Senator Jungbar, is just to make clear, this is a voluntary. I'm sort of looking at the language and making sure it says it's voluntary. It's not voluntary for the city. For the city, this is an unfunded mandate, I think, right? But the business has a voluntary has discretion about whether they follow this or not, or even or do anything with it or throw it away. The form that is.
But this is a mandate.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sinjum,
Senator Jungbar.
I don't believe it mandates the cities use it. It just creates a form. It says Commissioner of Commerce. I guess we kind of envision more the Department of Energy Security might be the ones to create the form to actually do this inventory. But again, it's not mandatory. But a lot of cities, and especially Minneapolis and St. Paul, this would be nice for them to have somebody else create the form. because if they want to apply for these, Rochester as well could apply for these federal grant monies, $10 billion available for cities to actually inventory. And the federal grant money is available specifically to inventory energy use as it relates to a carbon footprint of businesses. So this would get everybody using kind of a standard form around the state and get our cities ready for available funds that should be available sometime in 2009.
Madam Chair?
Senator Sanchez.
Maybe just if you could clarify page 2, line 4 and 5, because that suggests to me that a municipality divided all the way from a fairly large city to a county to a township would need to send these forms or make available to. I don't know what that means, if it's come and get it or if it means to mail out or what. But
Senator John,
that's where I was looking at.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sinjum, line 2.7, the municipality shall make the inventory available to the public by electronic means. And I guess we envision that they would also make it available to the businesses by electronic means, but it would be, if the city decided to mail it out, it would be available that way. But that's how I envisioned it, was that they would make it available on their city website, which most cities have, and that the business could simply file it back on the website. And as well, for a business, then consumers could go in there, and businesses that did respond, they could choose to either do business with that business or not do business, but they could make assumptions that the business was cognizant of its energy use and was trying to use conservation measures. So it's a tool for consumers to use in making their choice of what businesses to do business with as well.
Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer, maybe just I agree. I think most cities probably and counties have websites, but with respect to a township that may not, some do, probably some don't, would they be required to mail the inventory out? Or the form out, I'm sorry.
Again, Madam Chair, Senator Sinjum, I didn't anticipate that. If we can figure out a way to make that more well known, but underline 2.4, just make available to business located within the municipality. Having been a mayor before, I think making it available could just be available in a file as you walk up to the front desk at the city. Our city had many of the forms available right at a desk at the front of the city.
Madam Chair, I'd be fine,
Senator,
with that.
Sanjum. Senator Jungbauer, have you received a fiscal note on this?
Madam Chair, I have not. We have discussed this with the Office of Energy Security.
Director Garvey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey, Director of the Office of Energy Security. It's my understanding that the obligation requested of this legislation would be for the Office of Energy Security to work with the author and others to develop a form and then make that public so that municipalities and their businesses could fill out the form in a helpful way to start identifying where their energy uses us. And we think that could be a useful part of our use energy information services and would consider that a part of our general duties, and so there's no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Okay, Senator Jungbauer. This has to go to business, industry, and jobs.
Okay. And I would request that we pass the bill as amended and move it on to business, industry, and jobs.
On Senator Jungbauer's motion, then, all those, or any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Is Senator Scogin here? But we'll take your second bill later.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Sustainable, organic, green, sequestration, next-gen climate change. This committee has heard it all, and we have all around the state of Minnesota incorporated those kinds of words into our vocabulary. Well, both at the state and national level, legislation has been passed or is being proposed that is going to protect our earth while trying to hold rates and reliability harmless. Much is being offered on a big scale. Well, today, committee and Madam Chair, you will hear a challenge to power providers to help make the transition from looking at users as customers and start seeing them as generators. In a time when we need to explore new ways to involve the public with new technology available this bill will be offering more of a carrot and less of a stick. For customers who are willing to make investment on a smaller scale, Senate File 2657 offers a $2,500 tax credit to individual customers and small businesses who invest in wind power. With me today are Dean Harrington, president of the First National Bank of Plainview, Minnesota, and Dan Matfield, who is a manager of a residential wind power incorporated in New York Mills, Minnesota. And Madam Chair, I would yield to the testifiers to bring you up to speed on what we are proposing with Senate File 2657. Dan, why don't you identify yourself?
My name is Dan Matfield. I'm general manager for residential wind power in New York Mills, Minnesota.
Welcome.
What we're proposing is a tax credit for residential homeowners and small business owners around the state who are willing to invest in wind-generated electrical systems. And basically, it's the small systems, not the 10, 25-megawatt systems like you see going up all over the place, but these are just for individual homes and businesses that range in that are under the size of 10 kilowatts of generation. A lot of these systems that we're looking at cost in anywhere from a range from $6,000 to $7,000 to $18,000. So we're looking at a credit that would be equal to 35% of the installation up to $2,500 at a cap.
What would 10 kilowatts power?
10 kilowatts would actually sustain an entire home and actually produce, in most cases, more than the average home uses and would then supply the power back to the electrical utilities.
Madam Chair, that really, depends on what kind of a home you have. If you're all electric, including heat, if you have a family of six instead of a family of four, your power needs, obviously. If everything in your home is electric, 10 would maybe be a stretch.
Yes.
It might be at a 15 at that point. But maybe a typical home with some natural gas heat or some appliances, 10 may be able to supply that kind of energy.
Right. My statement was based on the national average four-person home, which uses approximately 1,000 to 1,200 kilowatts of electricity per month.
Okay. And Mr. Matfield, how large is this wind generator?
They're going to vary in size. There's some that are as small as 6 feet in diameter for the blades, and some that up to 15 to 20 feet in diameter.
Okay, and thank you.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Is there any danger of these? Of installing these in residential neighborhoods, for instance?
No, as long as all of the building codes are followed, technical specifications on foundations, which are given out by, have already been researched and implemented by the manufacturers, as long as the manufacturer specifications on foundations, there should be no danger whatsoever.
Mr. Chair, also with us today, Dean Harrington, president at First National Bank in Plainview. The tax credit itself is one piece of the puzzle to get the public interested. And Getting somebody to actually finance some of these projects is another piece of that puzzle, and I think Mr. Harrington is here today to address some of those concerns and some of those ideas.
There's another question we have right here, and Senator Jungbar, you have asked a question too. You want to? No, okay. There's on this section one, letter C, on a product certified by the commission. How is that going to work? Certification on that. And I guess there was something on the back here as well we wanted to know. On subdivision 4, the commission may certify a product as a small wind power generator. So can you describe that process for us?
Dan, that's
basically, most as long as they're certified and UL approved, it would seem to me to be considered certified.
I think that language, Mr. Chair, and I'm taking a stretch by addressing it, but I think that is in regards to products that generate electricity have to be UL certified. If you buy a generator,
council is saying that might we may need to tighten that language up there. So I might want to address that. I don't know if other members have some input on that. Otherwise, we can. I don't know if you can. Where does this move on to after this?
Taxes, I believe.
Taxes,
Mr. Chair.
Like I say, council is saying that definitely needs to be tightened up as far as language. So I'm not sure exactly how to do that. But
council has some language in mind. I'd certainly be willing to listen.
Okay, we'll work on that. Any other questions from members? Comments, Senator Rosen.
And to the witness, Mr. Matfield, how about the supply available for some of these generators and turbines? Is there, as you know, the larger units are in high demand, and there's a backlog. Is there manufacturers that are addressing this right now?
The main manufacturer that I've been working with personally is Southwest Wind Power, based out of Flagstaff, Arizona, and they produce several different styles and sizes of generators and turbines, and they have a large manufacturing facility that the availability is, they're quite available and accessible through the dealers.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Matfield, you said Southwest Arizona?
No, Southwest Wind Power, based in Flagstaff, Arizona.
In Flagstaff. That's where Senator Anderson's bill would come in handy. And was that in this
not
committee?
In Southwest Minnesota.
That's right. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I had some questions about the product as well. Do you have any brochures or anything, any pictures of these things?
If you want to write this down, I can give you you can.
Sure.
Dan, is this a current one?
That is a current one for this one of the products for the SkyStream, but you can either go to SkyStreamEnergy.com or WindEnergy.com to see a line of their products.
And Mr. Chair,
yeah, we just did.
I know we're going to hear from the finance guy in a second. Maybe he can tell us how much does a typical residential unit cost?
On the SkyStream, on the other types, I have not done a full analysis on what total cost would be, but on the SkyStream itself, our base price begins at about $10,500.
And so, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble,
how long does it take to realize energy savings to pay for capital
to like that? Pay for itself is anywhere from 7 to 10 years on average.
Mr. Chair, I'll just. You said sometimes there's some excess. Do your installations include some way to reverse the flow and put energy out on the grid, or
the reversal of the flow is just any outgoing is just immediate. It's not something that has to be controlled. Mm-hmm. It's when the unit is producing electricity more than what your home is using, it'll take any excess that's building, and it's connected into your grid already. Mm-hmm. And so it'll just it flows back out the line
right.
to the through the meter, which calculates how much has been how much they the utility has received mm-hmm. from you as a generator, and then they have to pay you based on how much you provided in kilowatts to them.
I've heard in certain parts of the state, I don't that there. I think it was in certain parts of the state where the proposal was that the electric company would buy your power at wholesale rates and then sell it back to you at retail rates. Have you heard any of that going on?
I'm not exactly sure on what the prices are. It depends upon the business on who's selling it back to them. If it's the residential, if it's a small business, there is a difference on both.
Before we get to Senator Vanderveer, I wanted to have Senator Jungbauer speak to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and yeah, that was one of my issues. Is I've had people contact me in dealing with different energy companies and East Central. Electric, I think that's what they call it, north of me, what they do is they charge like a $3,500 permit fee just to hook it into the grid, and that doesn't include the price to hook it into the grid. It's just the permit fee, and then they make you sell 100% of the electricity back to them at wholesale and then buy your energy from them at retail. So by the time you're done, it's a no-win situation.
See, now, and I haven't run into anything like that at so far. When we installed ours at our office in New York Mills, Otter Tail Power Company was right there. We never were charged anything. We signed an agreement for the payback, and we had to basically a contract with them. So if we provided electricity, that they would pay us back at a specific rate. I'm not sure what the rate was, but there was no type of fees charged on any of that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, under current PURPA laws, if it is a generator of 50 kilowatts or less, the utility that provides power to you, it's on a separate meter, and they are required to purchase it back at the retail rate.
It's under Minnesota.
Okay.
Right. Isn't
that Minnesota
law?
No, okay.
They don't do that in East Central Electric.
Speaking from someone who served on an electric co-op board, not as a legal counsel to electric rate or the electric industry.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Vanderveer, did you still have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Skogan, do we have any idea how much this would be expected to cost?
To cost the customer?
No, the tax credits.
I don't expect it would cost the taxpayers.
No, the state. Wouldn't there be a cost to this?
There would be.
Senator Dibble.
There will be a cost because it's a credit, and so that's there's a fiscal note that'll be reflected that'll show up.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Senator Vanderveer. I thought you were talking about we're still talking about getting hooked up and sending it back to the power company. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Is there a fiscal note on it, or
Senator Skogan?
I don't believe there is.
Yeah, one.
It is complete.
We're going to be going to taxes after this, so I assume that something will be drawn up.
Yeah.
All right. I think Senator Rosen.
No, thank you. And Senator Skogan, I love initiatives like this. I think they're innovative. We're using our resources that are out there. I've been working for 4 or 5 years on a biomass burning stove tax credit, and I still haven't got that done. So I wish you the best of luck. But something that you're going to have to probably address at some point with this bill is the manner of where these turbines are placed on property, not to offend neighbors, surrounding areas. That is something that's happening with bigger turbines, of course, but there is that issue of as far as setback and placement, and I think we should all just address that. But I wish you the best of luck on it. I think it's
Thank
a great
you,
idea.
Senator Dibble.
Just one suggestion. And I see Mr. Pfeiffer is in the room. So, you haven't yet heard my speech about how I believe that distributed, you know, local, on-site based generation is a form of efficiency. It's a form of conservation and efficiency. And so one thought in order to access some resources for folks who want to install these rather than going the tax credit route might be to work with utilities to see if there's some tie into their conservation improvement programs, see if there's some compatibility there. They may hate it. They may love it. Can't tell right now. He's just smiling nicely, but it's a conversation worth having because especially, you know, with our billion-dollar deficit that we're facing, there may be some other place to go for resources.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, it's kind of like a lot of things we do strike me as we're going back to the future. My folks used to drive ride all over the cities in a streetcar, and, you know, up in our area before electrification came in, every farm had a generator on the windmill. A lot less than $18,000 or $10,000, but, you know, and then they'd have a 6-volt system running lights into the barn. And it just makes so much sense that in the rural parts of our state, you know, where there's not those issues with the neighbors 100 feet away, but maybe a quarter mile away, you know, for people to have a wind generator, it really makes a lot of sense to me.
Other comments, questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could ask Mr. Harrington to present some of his testimony.
Certainly.
Regarding financing.
We're working on Mr. Harrington. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I did circulate an outline that looks like that with a black strip down the side of it. But
Mr. Harrington, could you just for the record, I don't know if you've already testified, identify yourself for the record.
Okay, Dean Harrington. And I work in a bank, have for 38 years in a small southeastern Minnesota town called Plainview. We're about 25 miles northeast of Rochester and have a mix of agriculture and other industries in our community. And I guess I bring this, the perspective I bring to it is small, it is relatively rural, and there could be other applications of this bill that I'm not qualified to talk about at all. I will say, though, in answer to the question about that the senator raised about zoning issues, the town of Plainview, and we're about 3,300 people in the town itself, the city itself, and we're working on zoning issues with respect to the placement of units like this in the community. And I'd also say that our bank has customers who already have units or who are considering units like this who would not be hooking to the grid. They would use it and consume all of their energy production on site. So so I think there's variations of this, including a net metering situation. But to date, the very few that we've had contact with have been utilizing all of the produced electricity in their own home or small business. And the outline that I circulated has just 5 main points to it, and they kind of address some economic development aspects of this bill. And the first one is, and they're all advantages. I'm in favor of this bill, but the first one is that it emphasizes small community self-reliance. Some bullet points under there are becoming more self-reliant for energy can be a key element in small community economic development. We're discussing it in our community at this time as an economic development strategy. Reducing the outflow of energy dollars from small communities is an advantage. Avoiding future cost increases in conventionally generated electricity means more of future income can be devoted to other needs. A second point is it's especially helpful for small rural communities. And the 2 points I wanted to emphasize under there is that Small wind is particularly valuable for rural communities because it does not depend on large concentrations of population. Some other development directions do, and this one doesn't seem to. Sparseness of population may well be an advantage with more space to work with in rural areas, going back to, again, the impacts on neighbors and so forth. But it's one of the few things that I've seen that sparseness is a somewhat of an advantage. Three, it does not drive high-risk co-development, and by that I mean that the development of small wind will not result in a high concentration of financial risk compared with other development projects. It's $10,000 to $15,000. It's not a $5 million deal or a $133 million deal. So it's a manageable risk, and from both the consumer standpoint and whoever finances them, and I work for a bank, so we always look at that. Fourth, the one that's most important to me, or one that's very, very important, I should say, is that it gives small scale a chance. And the point I wanted to make there is that in a time when so many resources seem to be focused on making things work on a large scale, the tax credit for small wind would be a signal that making things work on a small scale is often more efficient. Not always. Small isn't always beautiful, but I think we do shortchange small-scale applications of new directions and technologies simply because we seem to think everything needs to get bigger. And I think there is a place for small-scale development, and the more we can signal that it's important and that it's credible and not trivialize it, and the better off we'll be as a society going forward. And then five, environmental benefits, and I don't think I need to spend a lot of time on that, but I think it would have those too. So really those are my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Harrington. Any questions from members? Senator Rosen.
Okay. Senator Scogin, and to your witnesses too, I just last week in this committee, we heard the microenergy grant program through the Office of Energy and Security, or Department of Commerce, actually. And it's selling revenue bonds up to $20 million for small-scale renewable energy projects and wind, solar, anaerobic gas digesters. It goes on and on. I don't have the bill in front of me. But this fits right in line to what you're trying to do. And if I could, Mr. Chair, could I have Deputy Commissioner Mike Bull come up to the table, please?
Deputy Commissioner, yes, please. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Bull, could you just explain to the committee and to Senator Scogin how that would work exactly?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Senator Rosen, as you know, as you well described, we're looking at creating a program that would be funded through the sale of state revenue bonds to create a loan program working with local units of government in order to fund projects, installations exactly as has been described here today, and all the benefits of the technologies that as these folks have been talking about, we heartily, absolutely support and will confirm to you that those are very good things, and we're trying to promote them as well. The only issue with this bill in particular is the general fund implications, and we just have to work through that. But the intent and the technology that they're trying to get to, we're trying to do is we have a proposal to do is in a different way. And these things don't necessarily have to be mutually exclusive; they can be worked well together.
And Mr. Chair, that was my point: is to make sure that perhaps we did find a funding source, or perhaps these two programs can move simultaneously, and we can and get these initiatives rolling and get something out there.
Yep.
Other questions? All right, I believe we have an oral amendment that council is going to offer at this point to speak on it and on that issue earlier about certification.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if the commission is here, Mr. Chairman, members, but it seems intuitive when you look at the certification requirement that it's unclear how that would happen. I mean, does every individual person go in and have it certified? If there's a new item, a new product on the market, how long does it take to get it certified? And I don't think this is something the commission does. They don't certify products for whatever. I was told it was safety. So I would think you might want to consider at this point removing all references to the commission certifying it, because I mean, I don't know if they're here, but I don't think they do it, and I don't think it would be the sort of procedure that would facilitate the installation of these sorts of products. And I was told it was for safety reasons, but I don't think that's they're in the business of safety engineering products for the consuming public. So
Mr. Fuller,
if you agree, if somebody wants to pursue that, I can offer or I can suggest language that would do that.
Well, if you could suggest the language, then, so we know what we're talking about here in the bill, and then we can discuss it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, on 1.8, you would delete that, 1.8. On 1.9, you'd delete B and insert A. You would delete 1.12 and 1.13 lines. You would delete the word certified on line 1.15. And on page 2, you would delete subdivision 4, which is 2.1. to 2.3, the intent is to get to eliminate all references to certification for the reasons that I stated. And I think that does that.
Senator Scogin, would you give us your input on that?
Mr. Chair, I couldn't have done it better myself. Thank you, Mr. Fuller, for saving me some time after we leave here.
Mr. Chair, I move that amendment.
Okay. Was there a question? I'm sorry.
She moved it.
Okay, Senator Rosen, you move that?
I move that oral amendment.
Senator Rosen moves that oral amendment. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Any further discussion? Senator Rosen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to move the bill.
Okay.
I move that Senate File 2657 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to tax.
Senator Rosen moves Senate File 2657 be referred to pass and pass and refer to taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
All right. Thank you for your help, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, we're going to go to Senator Jungbauer's bill, Senate File 3546. Okay. Then we'll have one more bill after that. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 3546 is relating to a tax exemption for an electric generating facility, a peaking plant from Great River Energy in the city of Elk River. And I have Rick Lancaster from Great River Energy and Nick Zerwas from the city of Elk River here to testify.
Who'd like to go first?
I'll go first, Mr. Chair, with your permission. My name is Rick Lancaster. I'm Vice President of Generation at Great River Energy. We're an electric cooperative. We provide energy at wholesale to 28 member co-ops in Minnesota. This is, as Senator Jungbauer said, a personal property tax exemption for a 170-megawatt peaking plant fueled primarily by natural gas with fuel oil backup. It's a $100 million project. The value of the tax exemption is about $1 million a year. These plants don't produce much energy. They're there mainly for reliability. They're there to follow customer demand up and down during the day. They're also good at following wind power up and down. and we run them to offset that. Projects such as this would not be feasible to be built in Minnesota without a personal property tax exemption. We continue to pay, of course, the real property tax on the land and the buildings. None of the surrounding states to Minnesota have this type of taxation on power plants. This was in last year's tax bill, was totally non-controversial at that time, so we're back here again before you again today. We've got good support for this from the construction trades, from Sherburn County, and from the City of Elk River, but I'll let Mr. Councilmember Zerwa speak to that. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lancaster. Mr. Zerwas.
Thank you very much, Chair. Move this a little bit closer. My voice a little soft. My name's Nick Zerwas. I serve on the City Council in Elk River and also on the Economic Development Authority within the City of Elk River. The City of Elk River, City Council, and the Economic Development Authority have both passed resolutions supporting this project, and I'll be your shortest speaker of the day. We're very excited about the proposed peaking plant.
Thank you, Mr. Zerwas. Any questions from members? Anyone else like to speak on this issue? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Haney. I'm legislative and political director for the IBEW Minnesota State Council. We also support the project and would urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Further questions, comments? If seeing none, Senator Jungbauer.
I'm not sure where this
we're
going
to
go to
taxes with this one, too, and I assume
well,
we'll get a fiscal note at that time as well.
As we all love to see, Senator Bach. So I would move that Senate File 3546 be recommended to pass and moved on to taxes.
Senator Jungbauer moves 3546 be recommended to pass and referred to taxes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Jungbauer. And the final bill of the day is from Senator Carlson's Senate File 1948.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, it was just a suggestion for moving the rest of the time.
I had those jelly beans. Okay. Ooh, hop it.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, we are here to present something a little bit different. This is a resolution, and what it is to resolve and notify the legislature and pass it on to the governor about the notion of peak oil. Peak oil has a lot of definitions. Just about every person that speaks of it will give you a little bit of a definition difference. And I have a citizen expert here, Mr. Norm Erickson, who will tell us what his definition is. And I'm just to get you ready a little bit, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my definition. Right now, there's according to the GM finance director, Rick Wagner, there's no doubt the demand for oil is outpacing supply at a rapid pace and has been for some time now. According to the President of the United States, energy demand has outstripped new supply. That's why there's high prices. According to the chairman, David O'Reilly, chairman and CEO of Chevron, energy will be one of the defining issues of this century. One thing is clear, the era of easy oil is over. And then last fall in the Wall Street Journal, after years of discounting predictions of peak oil production, industry leaders and some officials of oil-producing nations now say oil production will plateau during or before 2012. Well, peak oil has been predicted probably over the last 40 years, for about the last 40 years. But one thing we do know for sure is that peak oil is coming. Peak oil does not mean we're running out. It does not mean we're not finding new oil. It does not mean we're not finding new ways to recover oil. It does not mean we cannot become more efficient in our uses of oil. It does not mean more renewables and substitutions can be found. But what it does mean is all of those things will not back off our need for oil. And with 1,000 cars a day being added to the streets of India, 2,000 cars a day being added to the streets of China, we're all going to be in competition for the same oil. And once that demand cannot be matched by our production of oil, the price of oil will suddenly have a chain reaction, and you will not be able to buy oil no matter what you pay for it. It will instantly increase in value. It will be the most precious commodity ever known. Now, what oil means to us is it means plastics. It means pharmaceuticals. It means fertilizers. And, of course, it means energy. Right now, most of the energy derived from oil is used to drive around. But so with that in mind, have to think about what we need to do to make sure that our use of oil is responsible and is in concert with a plan for whatever we're going to do with oil in the near future. This is not so far away. So with that, I'd like to pass the baton here to Mr. Norm Erickson, and he has a presentation that he would like to give to you.
Mr. Erickson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Senator Dahl and committee members, I'm Norm Erickson. I'm from Rochester, energy activist. I spent a majority of my time related to energy looking at the issue of peak oil and natural gas the last 5 years. I read a book in 2003, I think it was, called The Party's Over by Richard Heinberg, and it ruined a vacation. And I've really spent a lot of time on it since. It's a serious problem. It gets very little press in this country. There's no politician wants to talk about it, save a couple in the U.S. House that have formed a peak oil caucus. And it's the big elephant in the room. It's an issue that is going to address the lives of everybody in this room, everybody in this city, everybody in this state, and everybody in the country and the planet, and it's coming soon. And we haven't got a plan. We haven't got a clue. You know, folks are grumbling, and I suppose you hear a lot of noise about the price of energy and how expensive gasoline is. It's compared to what? Today on the New York Mercantile Exchange, just before noon, the price of crude oil, 42-gallon barrel of crude oil, was approaching $110. It wasn't much over a decade ago. It was $10 when we were bankrupting the Soviet Union with pushing oil prices into the basement. What do you get for $110 when you buy a barrel of oil? Is it cheap or expensive? Well, if you consider that the energy content of a barrel of oil is the equivalent of any one of us working 40-hour weeks for 12 years, you have to say it's a heck of a deal. You go to the union hall and hire the labor to move your 4,000-pound vehicle and 100 or 2 pounds of meat down the highway 30 miles in 30 minutes and see where you get. Is energy cheap or expensive? $3 for a gallon of gas is a bargain. And someday soon, we're going to have to deal with the fact that it's been way underpriced. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story and show you why. You know, we live in really incredible times. If you go back in history, prior to the time of Christ and up until the 1700s, we had maybe a half a billion people on the face of the earth. And there was a time in the 1800s when a steam engine was invented to pump water out of the coal mines in England, where they had to go to coal because they'd used up all their wood building ships and heating homes. And we got into the industrial age. And initially it was coal, And then it was oil, and the oil was because we were looking for a replacement for whale oil for lighting. Then we had this waste product, and we looked for a use for that, and it along came an internal combustion engine and a diesel engine. And then we powered the economy and food production such that we were able to increase from decade to decade on an exponential growth curve, the growth of population. Population didn't create energy demand. Energy created industrial agriculture and the food to grow the population. And there's other factors, of course, too, but that's the key thing. And if we look at energy production over time, and I know you can't read the details here, but if there were a few more data plots points plotted on that chart, you would see the increase in energy growth on the bottom right is even faster than population growth. Today in this country, we have about 20, well, it's about 100 energy slaves per capita working for us through fossil fuels. And as Senator Carlson pointed out, there isn't anything that hits our line of sight. There's nothing in this room or us or anything in this community that isn't there because of the services of petroleum and natural gas. And it's about to change. We've lived in a climate of growth for the last 150 years. We're going to have to start thinking about how we're going to deal with a climate of energy descent and economic descent, and we don't have a clue. 90% of the oil consumed on the planet since the beginning of time has been since 1957. Half of it just since 83. Unbelievable. And it's a one-way trip through engines and furnaces and turbines and whatever. Back in the 50s, there was a geologist named Dr. M. Marion King Hubbard that worked for Shell Oil down in Houston. And the guy had enough time in the business to be able to look backwards and say, you know, it's really interesting. When we find a new oil field, there's a delay, maybe 10 years, we put in the infrastructure, the roads, the pipelines, the wells, the tanks, and all that power and stuff that it takes to run an oil field, and then we start producing. And it produces for a while, we stick more holes in, we produce for a while, and then we go into decline. We keep putting holes in the ground in that oil field, and the decline continues. It's like drinking a glass of milk, you know, when it's gone, it's gone. Generally, it's never 100% gone. When they're pumping up in the 90-95% water, it's no longer worth because you're producing more waste than you're getting value out of the energy. Well, anyway, he took this idea, and he said, you know, let's look at this. We'll aggregate all of the fields in Texas, and we can kind of develop a bell-shaped curve. We could aggregate all of do this for all of the fields in Oklahoma and Arkansas and the north central part of the country and California, Pennsylvania, and so on, and we could develop a curve for the country. And they did that. And he said, you know what? We're going to peak oil production in the U.S. around 1970-71 because there's an interval that's dictated by statistics and the rate of development that says when you find oil, you develop it, you can only pump it so long and it goes down. It's just geology. And here's what happened. He knew that the peak in oil discovery in the lower 48 occurred in 1930. That's a long time ago, folks. And we peaked in production 40 years later. And we've been in decline ever since. Now, there's a shoulder that I'll show you in the next chart when we brought Prudhoe Bay online. The North Slope, that was the biggest field ever discovered in the U.S. But right now in the lower 48, we're producing at about 45% of what we were back at the peak in 1970. And it's an irreversible decline. We've since it's peaked, we've been all over out in the Gulf. And, you know, there's roughly half a million holes have been poked in the continental U.S. And the decline is a one-way trip. So this shows the shoulder put on the right. 1970s and 80s from Alaska. And look what happened here off on the right. Since 2003 to 2007, the number of rigs that are out drilling holes in the ground went up by about two-thirds, and the production has continued to decline. And we'll probably end up going into ANWR and being deeply disappointed and going into the near Rockies and being disappointed. This is what's happening at the planet level. Oil discovery for the planet peaked about 1964. All of this oil under the curve is gone. And now you see discovery is far less than what consumption is. So we're eating into the reserves that are left above the curve in the earlier years. The numbers you see is we're using somewhere between 4 and 9 barrels for every barrel we find. It's like drawing out of a savings account. We're going in the hole, and it gets worse year over year. This is a chart that's page 4, lower right, on a document that's on the web today from ExxonMobil. It's February 2004, and the green represents existing fields. The red is new production. Exxon says where existing fields are declining at a rate of 4 to 6% a year. Cambridge Energy Research Associates recently said it, they figured it's about 4.5% a year. And that may be true on average, but it's not true overall. As an example, the Canarel field on the north side of the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, which is the second largest field ever discovered, peaked in 2005. In 2006, it was down 20%. Last year, I think, down 16%. This year, they expect to be down 14%. In less than 5 years, Mexico will not have oil to export. Plus, they've got internal consumption growing rapidly. They're a big supplier to our Gulf Coast refineries. The net of that, guys, is we're in trouble. We're hanging on a thread. And when you look at what's happening year over year, this is 2005 over 2004, there's four of our majors that were down. If you look at 2006 over 5, we're down. 2007 over 2006, we're down. And you look at ExxonMobil last year, they spent more money buying their stock back than they did on exploration and development because there's more money in it. It's like they're going out of business. Two-thirds of the oil-producing nations on the planet have peaked. It's trouble for us. An example of the challenge is there's an Iranian oil field, the Yadavaran field. It was in the papers back in July of 2004, and they said, gee, there's a big field here. You know, it was really a giant 17 billion barrels of oil in the ground. But because of the geology, the type of the reservoir rock, the weight of the oil, and so on, they said, we think we could maybe get 3 billion out of the ground. It's a lot left behind, and that's typical. I said, when that field, that big field is developed, we should be able to pull 300,000 to 400,000 barrels of oil a day out of the ground. Sounds like a lot of oil, but that's only 0.5% of what we're using today. We'd have to find 10 of these a year just to stay even. And who's going to get the oil? You know where most of the oil is. It's not where we have a lot of friends anymore. But bomb diplomacy just doesn't work today. Though we're experiencing the biggest wealth transfer in the history of the world, and you know who's getting it and who's not. You know, in World War II, we won the war with American oil. We were the largest producer on the planet, we were the largest exporter, and we were the largest creditor nation. Today, we're down the list, I remember, 3, 4, 5 in terms of production. We're the biggest debtor nation, and we're the biggest importer. We're approaching 2/3 of our oil now is being imported. Back in the 80s, when OPEC was formed and prices were down on oil, Kuwait, they had decided that the production quotas amongst that cartel was going to be based upon proven reserves. And so they said, well, you know, everybody had a number. And Kuwait said, we got more than what we've been saying. They doubled their proven reserves number without the field work, without the seismological work, without the test wells and the drilling and the pumping and so on to prove it. They just said, we got it. and everybody else blinked and said, you know, I'm not going to lose either. And everybody took the reserves up. Those are paper reserves. They don't exist. And they have been quoted and used in the British Petroleum Annual Statistical Review and used by our U.S. Geological Services and used by the International Energy Agency and used by the DOE's Energy Information Administration for decades. And it's delusional oil, paper oil. If you go and look on the web today and you say, what are Kuwait's reserves? What you'll find in current information is they probably got 90-some million barrels of oil in reserves, and privately, people internal in the Kuwaiti oil organization that says probably half of that. What do things look like to the IEA and the EIA? That's the IEA is in Paris, and it's for the OECD community of nations, 30 non-OPEC nations, Western nations. And here's what they're seeing, and we'll just look at the two curves, the green smooth curve and the purple smooth curve. Basically, production has been flat since 2005. Why would production be flat since 2005 when we're hitting record oil prices? And we're off the chart today. It's not $85. It's up at close to 110, 107, I think, last time I looked today. Why is that, guys? Why aren't they making a bundle of money by shipping more oil? Why do they keep refusing to increase production? Why, when Saudi Arabia raised their production the last time, was a bunch of sour crude that not many folks can process? A high sulfur, heavy weight oil that we really don't like much because it's not easy to make gasoline out of it. So where are the reserves? Well, it looks like the majority is in the Middle East. Those are inflated numbers. The U.S. number over on the left represents about 2%. And we burn about 25%. A simple word for that is unsustainable. It can't continue. Russia's peaked. Saudi Arabia probably has peaked. Now, so this is kind of an overview. U.S. lower 48 peaked in 1970. Europe peaked here in the end of 2000. You know, when we had all of the turmoil in the 70s in the Middle East, the Six-Day Revolution, the overthrow of the Shah and all that stuff, and oil was withheld from the market. It was probably a global shortfall of about 5%. And oil prices went through the ceiling, and all kinds of things happened in industry and in business to become more efficient users of energy, and we had a global dip in consumption, as you can see on the top. Russia's peaked. There's probably 70 other nations in other. Middle East is probably peaking right now. It's kind of state secret, so it's only evident through the tracking that's done by companies like Petro Consultants that watch the number of ships that go out and how deep they are in the water and all that kind of stuff. It's by work. And this black is heavy oil, like the oil shell in the northwestern Colorado, the tar sands up in Alberta, and the heavy oil in the Orinoco oil sands in Venezuela and some others. There's a lot of that out there. You know, you've seen probably things in the press about Alberta has more oil than Saudi Arabia does. Well, you know, theoretically it's true, but the problem is it can't produce it fast. It's not about how big the reserves are. The issue is how fast can it flow? Can you keep the supply lines filled? They have enormous problems up in Alberta right now with growing production from the oil sands. They're producing about 1.2 million barrels a day. They're running out of water. They don't have the natural gas, and they got enormous lakes of contaminated water. It is a disaster. You can look at it on Google Maps and see what a mess it is up by Fort McMurray. So they're looking at capping that the growth up there. Then you got all kinds of CO2 emissions issues. The blue is deep water. Why are we going out into the Gulf in Hurricane Alley, 200 miles down 3, 4, 5 miles looking for oil if there's so much left and it's so easy to produce. Only an idiot would go out there unless there was no other choice. It's very expensive, very risky. And some of the announcements you've heard in the last year or two, like the Thule off of Brazil or the Jack off of New Orleans a couple hundred miles, yeah, maybe 10 years, maybe 15, maybe 20 before they're produced because we don't have the technology to do it. Running into metallurgy problems at those depths with the heats they encounter drilling. It's incredible. And the white is a polar oil that may or may not be there. There's some off the coast of Siberia. They're looking now off the northwest side of Alaska, but we don't know if it's there or not. The Russians planted a titanium flag in 15,000 feet of water under the North Pole, trying to claim it. I mean, countries are getting desperate looking into the future at what's going on with reserves. China's running all over the planet trying to buy into reserves. They don't give a hoot any more than we do about who's running the place. We'll make a deal. And I just want to say a couple words about natural gas, because the resolution that's Peak Oil Resolution also has a statement about natural gas. We also are in trouble with natural gas. We import about 56% of Canada's production. Most of it comes from Alberta, comes over. Most of it's used here in the north-central part of the country. And those three pipelines, they peaked last year. Alberta, the exports will probably be down about 8% this year. The U.S. peaked in 1973. We had a second lower peak in 2001, and we're on the way down, and here you can see it. We're drilling today about 27,000 gas wells a year, and production is falling. And we're drilling in miserable places, like into coal beds, and then fracturing the coal beds, and then putting turbines on to drive ranchers nuts to try to get the coal bed methane out. Coal gas. And what's Canada doing? Well, at the end of 2004, they were drilling about 16,000 wells a year. Production was just holding, reserves dropping like a rock. Well drilling is down now. Prices aren't high enough. How much is natural gas? Mercantile exchange this morning was right around $10 per million BTUs. If you look at an aggregation of all of the types of oil, and natural gas liquids, the whole deal, they're projecting a peak approximately 2010. Doesn't matter if it's 2010 or 2012 or 2014, it's all tomorrow in terms of readiness, in terms of the investment and the effort it's going to take to live through it, to come out the other side as a healthy community and a healthy nation. People say, well, you know, we need renewables. Go nuclear. You know, everybody's got a quick solution. Don't talk. I got to go to the bathroom. You know, talk about this peak oil problem and energy shortages and, you know, the fact that energy, really, money is a surrogate for energy, the way you think about it. And when energy goes away, money goes away. Wealth goes away. That's what happens. What does it take to replace a cubic mile of oil? A cubic mile of oil is about what's used on this planet in a year. Now, this chart and some text with it was in the IEEE Spectrum magazine. It's a journal of the electrical engineering community, the Spectrum of January last year. And they said, you know, it's really hard for people to relate to all these numbers of kilowatts and BTUs and megajoules and blah, blah. It says a cubic mile of oil is about what we use, a CMO. What would it take to replace a cubic mile of oil? Oh, simple. Build 1.6 megawatt wind turbines, 32,850 of them, every year for 50 years and then run them for a year, and you got 1 cubic mile of oil energy equivalent. Think about it. 91.25 million solar panel arrays. These are 2 kW arrays like you'd run on a house. 91.25 million a year for 50 years, and then run it, that array of arrays for a year, and you got the equivalent of today's oil usage. People say, well, go nuke. There was a presentation at the oil conference in Houston in October. A nuclear physicist came in and say, you know, we're not going to grow the nuke industry that much because we have the fuel for maybe a 0.3% growth per year. Half of the nuclear fuel that we've been running on here in recent years is coming from decommissioned weapons in the former Soviet Union. That runs out in 2013. Then what? Those people are not stupid. Why should you sell oil for $24 a gallon when you can see the bottom of the barrel coming? Why not sell it for $100? Why not sell it for $200? Why not sell it for $300? Why not? That's stewardship. That's being responsible to your people. Canada already has stirrings up there, resource nationalism kinds of stirrings. Why should a nation of 35 million people ship their 60% of their oil and 50-some percent of their natural gas to the U.S.? It's colder up there. Why should the Canucks shiver in the dark, they're asking themselves? Why? They're starting to think about whether NAFTA was really kind of a job on them. Maybe they don't belong in there. Carter knew. And we threw him out. I mean, the handwriting was on the wall decades ago. Nothing lasts forever. So, with falling oil supplies, rapidly escalating demand, natural gas production falling here, and it's difficult and expensive to move as a liquid. You got to chill it to minus 260 C. You got to keep it boiling so it doesn't explode to keep it cold. Then you got to regasify it. A lot of energy burned up on both ends, kind of wastes about 30%. And we don't have much capacity. And as new capacity comes available, the ships and the liquefaction things, who's closer to it than we are? India, China, Korea, Japan. Most of the rest of the using world community, Europe, so on. So we have to start thinking about the reality of what's going on with energy and what does it mean to us and where should we be making investments. We need to talk about it with our people. Nobody's talking about it. Our newspaper in Rochester is, I mean, it's like it's a non-existent issue for the most part. The most coverage I've seen in Minnesota, WCCO ran some shorts. Don Shelby ran some shorts called Project Energy. They're still out on the web. So maybe the party's over, guys. Read this book.
So, Mr. Erickson, why do you think that we're not talking more about it? Why do you think that there isn't more attention to this issue?
People are afraid of it. There's no simple solution. You know, the Representative Hilty had a couple of people from Portland come in, one from the Department of Energy and one from a nonprofit called the Post Carbon Institute. And they worked with the Portland, Oregon Peak Oil Task Force and published a book called The Planning for Climate and Energy Uncertainty, I think it is. And so there are some progressive places that are dealing with it. I mean, Red Wing has got a lot of activity going on, Red Wing, Minnesota. Portland has a lot going on. Sacramento has some. It's scattered around. Rochester, it's a zero. They don't even recognize it as an issue, just a few of us off the wallers, you know.
Do you have a question? Okay. Are there questions or comments? No, if the committee will indulge me, I'd like to call on Representative Hilty. I know that it's frowned on to invite members of the opposite body to speak in our committees, but he would be speaking not in his capacity as a representative from the House, but because of his membership and his concern about this issue. And you'll have to tell me the name of the membership that you have.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I would be speaking in my capacity as a member of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. It's an organization that is international. It was founded approximately 10 years ago by prominent oil geologists who recognized that this problem was there, was growing, was inevitable. And that organization has met every year since, most recently in Houston, as Mr. Erickson referred. Madam Chair, I have very little to add to what Mr. Erickson said. I think that his assessment of the situation is right on. I am the House sponsor of the resolution, which actually is modeled on resolutions that have been offered across the country. And I would point out to members that members of the association have assisted a group of legislators in Connecticut who put together a report, which I would be happy to make available to members of the committee. Madam Chair, if you're interested, that basically echoes, again, what Mr. Erickson, in a very abbreviated presentation, has characterized for the committee. I think that this is beyond debate at this point, Madam Chair and members. It hasn't been very many years ago that the question of global warming and climate change was at the point that no one was quite willing to say that this is really happening. Some people think it is, some people think it isn't. And that was back and forth for quite some time. And I think that that issue has been pretty well settled by the scientific community. And I think that we are at the point right now with global energy production, both petroleum and natural gas, that question is rapidly being settled by the scientific community, by oil geologists, by industry experts. Madam Chair, to recall, we had a joint hearing on this issue in the House in early February with one of the leading international experts, a Houston oil banker and a student of oil production on the planet named Matt Simmons, whose conclusions actually are that contrary to even what Mr. Erickson suggested, where we have industry people saying, well, maybe we haven't peaked already, maybe it will occur in the next few years. I think the consensus now is developing on the year 2012, but Mr. Simmons is quite convinced and quite convincing, in my view, that in fact that has already occurred. He points out that when M. King Hubbert accurately predicted the peaking of petroleum production in the United States, it was not recognized that that had occurred for at least 3 or 4 years after the fact. And, Madam Chair, I think that that's pretty much where we are right now. Okay. Not good news.
Thank you. Senator Carlson, do you have any additional words?
Quite possibly a couple. If you remember, about 10 years ago, there was something that we all started to be afraid of. You couldn't touch it. You couldn't experiment with it. People tried to, but it was called Y2K. And there were a lot of there was a lot of anxiety over that. The computer people said that, you know, our computers are going to shut off, their software is going to fail, there's going to be lots of things that might happen. other computer people disagreed with it. Some of them were somewhat correct, some of them weren't. We spent millions of dollars rewriting a lot of software because we could, you know, we could test some things. But as it happened, we weren't affected too much because a lot of those things you really couldn't touch, you couldn't feel. Well, this is something that you can touch, you can feel. You can take a calculator and figure it out. This is real. The only things that are still up in the air is how fast we're going to get to a point where this rapid runaway price is going to happen. And that's related to a lot of our behaviors around the world, a lot of where our energy is presently going, who is, like Mr. Erickson said, who is our friends and who isn't, who owns the oil, because the owners are going to have it first crack at it. We will have to buy most of it, and that's one of the things that is probably our biggest handicap, is that we will have to buy most of it. And at this point, I'm not sure if we're in the position to be able to buy a lot of oil. So I think that you asked an absolutely perfect question, is why aren't we talking about it? I'm a rather newcomer to this issue, and I think it was when I came over and listened to one of the presenters, and I have friends that have talked about it for quite some time, and I'm somewhat sensitive to it, or I was somewhat sensitive, but now I've really become more or less a believer that there is a lot of things that we're going to have to do, and it's probably going to take over an awful lot of our lives because we are an automotive economy, a petroleum economy, and when the easy petroleum goes away, we're going to have to figure out what to do, and it might not be very very fun.
Senator Dipple.
Thank you. Just two quick questions. One is just curious why we decided to do this in the form of a resolution and not a bill, giving direction to the.
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, we decided to do this largely because it has been done in other states, this direction, and primarily also because we wanted to get the principles out there in a resolution. And we think that there is ample reason to ask the state to recognize it, to ask the legislature to recognize it. And, you know, we could mandate something be done, but I think we've talked about this as recently as a few hours ago, and we thought that this is a reasonable way to go.
Makes sense.
Senator Dibble.
So at that point, which folks start believing that this is an issue and we start moving towards some policy changes and some actual changes, and we start looking at different sorts of transportation fuels, I'm glad you have in the whereas you touch on some issues where the cure may be worse than the illness. And specifically, I'm talking about biomass fuels, ethanol and biodiesel. And I think we've had some conversation on our environmental committees and here as well, where we need to figure out some, you know, that they're triggering some problems that are coming to light, and so we need to figure out some new and different approaches to the fabrication, manufacture of those sorts of transportation fuels, so they're not creating more problems. The other thing that I'm very fearful of is coal liquefaction, which creates more CO2 than anything else that we do. Coal creates more CO2 emissions than burning coal for electricity. It creates more CO2 than, you know, the production of tack. And I mean, you know, it's really bad, and that would be a really bad way to go. So as we start looking at solutions, you know, let's make sure that we're keeping some of those issues in mind.
Mr. Erickson, you want to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to comment on the coal thing. There was a study done last year by an Energy Watch Group. It was commissioned by the German Parliament, published. It's downloadable on the web, and one of the handouts that you should have has a link to it. Basically, the street smart say there's 250 years of coal, but don't worry about it. If we need more fuel, we can make it out of petroleum. when you look at what's going on in the coal business in this country, we have already peaked in terms of heating value, steam BTUs that are being shipped. Our best coal, our anthracite coal, is basically gone. Our best bituminous coal is in decline. What we're shipping today is more tonnage, but we're shipping subbituminous and lignite, the junk coal. I mean, the lower-grade coal, and we're going into thinner seams. And coal is not going to be an answer. They said we'll probably peak within 10 years, 15 years, with existing demands. It's not a choice for us for a fuel for transportation. And ethanol is not a solution either, with a 30% profit ratio, optimistically. I mean, you can't believe how much we won't eat. I mean, it's a dead end, period. You looked at the alternatives chart that we had up there. Hydrogen isn't on there, and ethanol is on there, because they're really not solutions. So it's such a big problem that it, you know why I think people don't want to be associated with it. They say, well, it's like being a pioneer, you know. And pioneers, how do you know a pioneer? The ones out in front with arrows in their back. I mean, who wants to be tagged as a, you know, one of those?
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at this in the bill. Be it further resolved, the legislature supports the adoption of a global oil depletion protocol. Could you speak about that and where it was developed and where we can get more information? And it kind of gives a little bit about what it's supposed to do, but if you could extrapolate a little bit on that protocol.
Senator Carlson.
Okay. What we're talking about is really developing that protocol, and there are active organizations around the country and the world that are working on those things, and that's something that we would like to see happen. We don't have it to deliver it, but that's something that we would like to see develop. And, Madam Chair, I do have another testifier that would like to read a statement into the record. It's a very brief statement.
Okay. Although we are going to have to speed up, there is a caucus going on right at this moment. So unless we recess and reconvene later on this evening, we're going to have to finish pretty quickly.
Extremely short.
Okay. State your
name for
the record,
please.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I'm Earl Knutson. I'm a retired engineer living in Wilmer. A 60-second statement. We have traveled here today from Wilmer to commend this committee and its sister committee in the House for drafting and bringing forward this resolution. In the past 3 years, I've done a lot of reading on the subject of petroleum supply, and I fully agree with the statements in the resolution. However, it's my impression that only 10% or so of the public knows this situation well enough to attach any degree of urgency to it. 10% is not enough to support concrete legislative action. This resolution will promote a much-needed public discussion of the issue. Once again, I commend the committee for this resolution. I hope it goes forward, reaches its destination, and is acted upon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, one last statement regarding the oil depletion protocol. Colin Campbell initially had a plan for it. He's one of the originators of forming forces in the Association of Peak Oil globally. Richard Heinberg, who is the author of The Party's Over and three subsequent books, it talks about an oil depletion protocol, and the net of it is this. If the global depletion of oil is, let's say, 4.5% per year, then all the nations of the world would also reduce their consumption at 4.5% a year. It requires the cooperation of nations for it to be successful in the big picture, but somebody's got to start. And so it just says that as the oil goes away, you start reducing your usage so that you can exit gracefully. All of a sudden, all kinds of entrepreneurial juices will be kicked into gear and things will start happening that are different than business as usual today. So that's the net of that.
Thank you.
Although we haven't started any of that, and I am still surprised that more people aren't talking about it. Well, you know, why do only 10% of the people know about it? Why hasn't there been there this hue and cry and concern about what's going on?
Madam Chair, if I could answer some of that, it's just not coming from the right places at this point. And I think if I were to be extremely blunt about
what we're facing here is this is the kind of thing that world wars are made of. This is the kind of thing that when we get to the point where it starts to get very, very scarce, we're just going to want it. We don't care how we get it. We're just going to want it. Okay. So, thank you.
Perhaps you'd like to move your bill.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1948. I don't believe we have another committee that it goes to. It goes through rules. Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1948, recommended to pass, and forward it to the Rules Committee.
Okay. Any comments or questions on Senator Carlson's bill or motion? Then on that motion, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
That does bring us to the end of our meeting. Since there is no further business, there will not be a meeting tonight. We will have another meeting on Thursday at 3 o'clock. And we have reserved space that evening, too. Hopefully we can complete our business during the afternoon meeting and won't have to reconvene in the evening. So if everybody could be here at 3 o'clock, at least to sign in, then we can start our business. We would like to have a quorum.